to the first general club of 2021. Let's hope 2021 is better than 2020, sorry. I'll dive straight into the articles for discussion. Time is short. So the first article is, it's basically three articles that I kind of put together. There's an editorial on the small cell lung cell subtypes, reassessing the subtypes by Yatabi. And then there's two articles where the authors did exactly that. They tried to reassess the subtypes and classify them better. And as we know, small cell lung cancer is generally treated by platinum etoposide, and people are looking at immune checkpoint inhibitors. But at the moment, this devastating disease, there's no cure. There's really just palliative therapy. And so the authors wanted to, basically, we tried to look at this disease in the similar way that we're looking at non-small cell lung cancer. We know it's multiple disease entities, and trying to see if there's targetable mutations and ways we can attack this disease. We still manage it like it's a single disease entity, biologically and clinically. Although we know the expression of neuroendocrine markers is well known to be variable in small cell lung cancer. Genomically, it's a very highly homogenous disease, with most cases characterized by the same inactivating alterations. However, we now know there's biological heterogeneity has started to emerge. But I wanted to do some background on this because there's a lot of things that are new, and I found it very fascinating digging into this. So we know a lot more about the biology of airway epithelium. So can you guys see me when I'm highlighting certain parts of the document?
Yeah. Good. Yeah, we can.
So there's a whole lot of research in the background. And we now know that the epithelial cell layer of the airways is a dynamic cellular structure, highly specialized cells which respond to each other, and there's quite a lot of plasticity in these cells. So this is an article I went to by Hewitt and Lloyd. And I've given you a copy of that in your Dropbox as well. It's not really part of this journal club, but it's just a very lovely background information on what's going on in research with the human airway epithelial cells. So these are the different types of cells: basal cells, suprabasal cells, secretory cells divided into club and goblet, deuterosomal cells were really described in the nose, ciliated cells, and then there's mucus ciliated cells, which you can see apparently in asthma. And then there's the 1% of cells, which are very rare in the airway, called the CFTR, ionocytes, pulmonary neuroendocrine cells, tuft or brush cells, and helix cells. And I've heard of brush cells, but I was a bit confused about them. I actually thought they were ciliated cells, so I was very wrong. This is a nice diagram by the same authors, which just shows this is the traditional landscape where I was. Goblet cells, ciliated cells, basal cells are the progenitor cells of all of these. And now we actually recognize, the basal cells are still believed to be progenitors. However, we have the tuft cell, and the tuft cell is illustrated here, which is believed to differentiate into the ionocyte and into the pulmonary neuroendocrine cells. So these tuft or brush cells have been previously called fibrillar vesicular cells, multivesicular cells, caviolated cells, and they were discovered more than 60 years ago in the rat trachea. And Thirlbeck in 1990, in a comment on human fetuses, said, "A rose is a rose, but what is a brush cell?" And these cells are fascinating. They're found in airway and lung and GI tract mucosal tissues, but other areas as well. And they're now recently been shown to be present in the thymus. They're chemosensory cells. They sent the sentinels of their environment, and they respond by secretion of all sorts of cytokines and mediators. They're also important in immunity against parasites in the intestine. And we believe they're the progenitors of the plumbing your endocrine cells. I call them PNEC and the CTFR-rich ionocytes. And these cells are obviously important in cystic fibrosis. The PNEC cells are resident within the surface epithelium, trachea, bronchi, and bronchioles, and they're also chemocenters, rich sources of neuropeptides and neurotransmitters. And a defining characteristic marker of PNECs is the gene ASCL1, which is a transcription factor. And it's believed that they are possibly the progenitor of the small cell carcinoma, but I don't think we're properly sure of that yet. Then there's another paper that I looked at when I was reading this, and it's all about smoking, the effects of smoking on the airways, which is also a fascinating read, and how it affects the cells. And it's interesting in that smoking causes tough cells towards functionally impaired ionocytes or PNEC-like states. And the smoker epithelium is rendered more functionally monochromatic. The usual phenotypes are collapsed at the expense of its normal defensive reactions to health and homeostasis. And I just copied this. I'll take all of these out of this document. Obviously, we're not allowed to have these when we send these to PBS, but it's just fascinating the amount of work that's been done on genes that are up in smokers and down in smokers. And as we know, small cell is very linked to smoking. And in fact, if somebody hasn't got a history of smoking, I will never diagnose a small cell in the lung because I think I have to think about something else. So this is from another paper that I've given you, which is very fascinating. Then coming back to Yatabi's editorial, he put this table in just to show the proposed small cell lung cancer subtypes and the previous studies that discuss this. And it's a lot of studies have looked at A, N, Y, and P groups, all based on domination of a certain type of transcription factor presence. So ASCL high, neuro D high, Y is usually double negative, but you've got YAP1 is another gene that has been described in these diseases. And then there's another gene called POU2F3. I'm going to call it PO for the purposes of this discussion, that is very high in PNEC cells. So on to the first paper that I want to discuss by Bain. And this is a group at Sloan Kettering. Bill Travis is on this, and someone called Charles Rudin. And Rudin has done a lot of work on small cell lung cancer. And his previous work has shown that the subtypes of small cell lung cancer are defined by these key transcription factors, as I've outlined already, these four. However, there are problems with this. Different studies have shown different things. And there's also supposedly a subset of ASCL, of AS, I'll call it ASCL and neuro, double negative, so-called non-neuroendocrine small cell lung cancer, because they didn't express any neuroendocrine cells, any neuroendocrine markers, and they express dependence on the PO transcription factor, which is a marker of tough cells. And there's not enough information on the expression of these genes in native clinical samples of small cell. A lot of this work has been done in cell cultures, in knockout mice using CRISPR, et cetera. So he wanted to look at what's actually going on in the human tissue. They also wanted to evaluate the expression of DLL3. I don't know if anybody's heard of this. Apparently it's another marker of neuroendocrine differentiation, and it's thought to be a therapeutic target. Has anybody heard of DLL3?
Yeah, actually, we had brought it on in our IHC lab because we were hoping it would really take off therapeutically, but apparently the therapy they had was very toxic. So they went back, and I don't really know where they are right now.
Oh,
it didn't really seem to take off as they had hoped.
Yeah. Does anyone use it to diagnose neuroendocrine disease?
No.
No.
Not us.
So they looked at 174 cases. So 122 were samples from just general diagnosed small cell cancer samples. And then 52 were samples that were made into tissue microarrays. They did immunohistochemistry against AS, neuro, PO, and YAP1. They also did the general, the usual markers against neuroendocrine markers, obviously TTF1, Ki67, and on the TMAs, they did TLL3. And they did the usual scoring criteria. They looked at the percentage of positive cells, intensity of labeling, and then had a histo score percent positivity of 0 to 300. For the neuroendocrine score, they had an average of 8 scores for all the 4 different neuroendocrine markers. So they call them neuroendocrine low if the scores were between 0 and 150, and high if more than 150. The scores for the transcription factors were 0 to 50 were called low, and more than 50 were called high. If the H score for AS or ASCL1 was more than NeuroD1, they were called ASCL1 dominant and vice versa. And obviously TTF1 was scored as either positive or negative. They did the usual Ki67 index. They also, this is their software. I won't talk about the what they did, but the two-tailed T-test analysis continuous variables worries me a little bit in that they didn't look at, they probably should have done an ANOVA, but I won't really go into that. So histologically, they found that they had 82% pure small cell lung cancers, and 18% were combined with adenocarcinoma, 77%, 3% was squamous, and 9% had large cell neuroendocrine as well. This just shows the expression. This table shows the expression of these markers in the different with the different H scores. But I think what's more informative are the these pie diagrams. So the pie diagram shown in A shows the expression patterns of ASCL1 and NeuroD1. So A ASCL negative, NeuroD1 positive. Double negative here is 14%. Cases that only stained with ASCL1 and ones with just NeuroD1. And then the distribution of the marker dominant subtypes. ASCL1 dominated in 69%, NeuroD1 dominated in 17%, and 14% double negative. And if you remember, ASCL1 is supposedly a marker for PNEC cells. So it kind of confirms what people know already, that ASCL1 is dominating in small cell cancers. It's interesting in that tumors with dual high ASCL1 and NeuroD1 expression showed that all but one case had both markers co-expressed in the same tumor cell populations. So obviously NeuroD1 is also playing an important role. The PO transcription marker PO was related to PNEC and the TUF cells. And this is expressed in 7% of small cell lung cancers. And interesting, it was mutually exclusive of ASCL1 and NeuroD1 and was actually often more common when there was a combined small cell lung cancer with some other type of cancer. YAP1 was expressed at low levels, primarily in combined small cell lung cancers again, but was not exclusive of other cell types. So in the final grouping, they had ASCL1 dominant AD, NeuroD1 dominant, double negative for those, but with PO expression, which I'm going to call PO, and then double negative for everything. So no PO, no ASCL1, and no NeuroD1. So that was called not otherwise specified NOS. They then took these groups that they made, these 4 different groups, and they looked at the relationship with neuroendocrine markers. And they found that AD and ND subtypes were much more commonly related to neuroendocrine marker high, TTF1 positivity, and DLL3 high. Whereas the PO and the NOS groups, which, as you recall, were ASCL and NeuroD1 negative, were neuroendocrine marker low and TTF1 low and DLL3 low. Ki67 had no difference in any of the groups. What's been shown before is that TTF1 was strongly linked with ASCL1. Because most small cell cancers with ASCL1 were TTF1 positive. NeuroD1 only expression were entirely TTF1 negative, and nearly all PO and most of NOS tumors were TTF1 negative, which I found very interesting, because our small cell cancers, sometimes they're negative for everything, just about, and you can just pick up a tiny little bit of synaptophysin sometimes, and I've gone on the morphology sometimes, and they're just negative for TTF1, negative for all neuroendocrine markers, but the morphology is so compelling. So it's interesting that they show these different patterns of staining. DLL3 was high in AD and ND tumors, but negative in PO and NOS tumors. So it looks like this marker, if it's important for treatment, is different, is differentiated by these transcription factors. They looked at a whole lot of patient and tumor characteristics, site of metastasis, et cetera, and they found no significant difference in small cell lung cell subtypes, but perhaps the sample size wasn't big enough and they didn't follow them for long enough. So the conclusions were that the double negative tumors represent a distinct neuroendocrine low subtype of small cell lung cancer, and it's either uniquely associated with the transcription factor PO or lacks a known dominant regulator. As I mentioned, TTF1 was consistently negative in Neuro1D tumors, but always positive with ASCL1. YAPI has a distinctly low expression and didn't define a distinct subtype of small cell lung cancers. So the distinctive nature of the PO positive cancers require more study. Therapies targeting DLL3 should be considered to patients that have high expression of DLL3. For now, it would be reasonable to classify small cell cancer into 3 subtypes or even 4 subtypes, including the PO transcription factor. And obviously many more studies are needed. Anybody got any questions about that?
No questions, Margaret, but thank you. That was very nicely done. Appreciate it.
Margaret, just so I understand, when we say it would be appropriate to subclassify small cell into 3 types, you mean as a research tool or I something that we should be doing in our practice?
No, it's not in our practice yet. No, a research tool. That was the conclusions by the authors. Yeah. Unfortunately, there's nothing really practical I'm showing you here today. Just the hope that one day we will be able to use markers to subclassify them for treatment.
Margaret, I have a question. Can you do this based on the molecular alone, or do you have to know that the histophenotype is small cell? In other words, can you bypass the pathologist and send the specimen to the molecular?
Yeah. It's a good question, Tom. I don't know if ASCL1 and NeuroD are present in other tumors. I know YAP1 is. I have to read that, because I know they said they only read the markers in the tumors that were small cell and they ignored anything else.
That's okay. I just was curious, because the concern is that, you know, we're going to become obsolete.
Yeah. I think we're a long way from it as regarding this tumor, at least. But I'm sorry, I'll have to look that up and get back to you about. I don't want to waste your time right now, but I'll look it up. Because I don't think ASCL1 and NeuroD stain non-small cell, but I could be wrong. But YAP1 stains any type of tumor, it seems. It seems to be positive in several. And I think the transcription factors are specific, but I'm not sure. Yeah. And the other thing is, though, that it's difficult to do everything based on molecular subtypes as well, because the amounts are important. So here they were able to quantify the protein staining, you know, not very accurately, but obviously you could say one was more dominant than the other, but with molecular testing, it's hard to do that. So you can't always just say IHC is similar to molecular testing. So we'll see. The next paper, which actually focus more on YAP1, I'll discuss that next, by Pearsall. And YAP1 is part of the tumor suppressive Hippo pathway, which controls cell proliferation, apoptosis, and organ size. So when the Hippo pathway is active, YAP1 is inactivated and sequestered in the cytoplasm for degradation. When the pathway is inactive, YAP1 binds nuclear transcription factors to direct pro-survival gene expression, proliferation, and tissue growth. So YAP1 nuclear activity correlates with chemoresistance, cancer stem cell renewal, and metastasis. And I think, for example, this is one they couldn't just do molecularly because you have to know it's in the nucleus. So maybe they still need us. I'm just joking. They do need us. I'm very convinced that they're going to need us for a long, long time. So the aim of this study was to evaluate YAP1 RNA and protein expression in circulating tumor cell-derived explant models, what they call CDX models, to provide a characterization of YAP1 at single resolution. And this is a continuation of some other work they've done previously, where they've taken these tumor cells, circulating tumors, and they've cultured them, and they've done all sorts of things, including RNA, single cell RNA sequencing. So I won't spend too long on all the methods. They're generated from patients enriched from blood samples. They took the blood pre-chemotherapy baseline or at post-treatment disease progression time points. They did RNA sequencing and immunohistochemistry or multiplex immunofluorescence of neuroendocrine and non-neuroendocrine subpopulations. They also included immunohistochemistry for synaptophysin and something called REST. REST is a repressor of neuroendocrine cell differentiation in SCLC. And they also looked at proteins for the same transcription, for the same markers, and AXL is something that's downline of YAP1. Sorry, of REST. So they showed that YAP1, if it was present, it was co-localized with REST, a repressor of neuroendocrine differentiation in small cell lung cancer. Concordant with reduced expression of synaptophysin, indicating non-neuroendocrine cell expression of YAP1. So in conclusion, they found that YAP1 was predominantly expressed in non-neuroendocrine cell clusters. And similar to the results by Bain, YAP1 expression alone did not define a single group. In some models, they found that NeuroD1 expression declined with disease progression because they had more than one sample from the same patient. And in other ones, YAP1 lineage emerged, which was interesting, showing that small cell molecular subtypes may have some plasticity. And they can go from one expression of transcription factor to another. So in future, small cell lung cancer subtyping may need to account for both temporal and spatial expressions of small cell lung cancer transcriptional drivers to fully appreciate the heterogeneity of this tumor. So my take-home message is really summarizing both of these papers. Overall, the emerging data on molecular heterogeneity of small cell lung cancer holds promise for biomarker-driven therapeutic options for this aggressive disease, but there's much more work that needs to be done. Yeah. So any further comments on these papers? Okay, so switching, it's funny how this journal club a lot of COVID, obviously, but then there was also quite a lot on malignant mesothelioma. So I think some of this might be a bit repetitive. You've heard it before, but I thought these were interesting studies. Perhaps we don't, if they haven't helped, we'll see how much new information they have, but I picked these anyway. So the next two papers are based on mesothelioma. So the first one by Marshall is a study done in a large UK mesothelioma center. And as we know, and I always have to just remind myself of this, if I haven't looked at mesotheliomas for a while, the homozygous deletion of cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor 2A is one of the commonest mutations in malignant mesothelioma. It's a tumor suppressor gene that codes for P16, and it activates retinoblastoma protein and P14, and which activates P53. So I'm going to refer to FISH for this gene as P16 FISH, although it's also picking up prints of P14 activations. So FISH is used to detect homozygous deletion of the gene, and it has to be homozygous deletion for this to be playing a role, which is why immunohistochemistry doesn't work, because it's not always homozygous, so we have to use FISH. I'm going to refer to it as P16 FISH, although it's not completely accurate. The Manchester University Foundation Trust is a regional mesothelioma center for the northwest of London, and they've been doing P16 FISH testing as an ancillary test case, a diagnostic test for cases suspected of mesothelioma since 2012, which I think they must have been one of the first people to do it. So their aims were to investigate the diagnostic performance of this test over these past few years, and to investigate the clinical characteristics and outcomes of patients with P16 FISH positive mesothelioma compared to those with negative mesothelioma. So they took all patients that had undergone P16 FISH testing for suspected mesothelioma over a 7-year period. And they made a note that P16 FISH testing is only utilized when atypical mesothelial cells are present, but a definitive diagnosis is not possible. And they said atypical cells must first be confirmed as mesothelian origin by immunohistochemistry. But I know that sometimes this isn't always possible, and sometimes just keratins are possible. So they might be a little bit too exclusive. So they had patients that had a final diagnosis of mesothelioma were categorized as P16 FISH positive or negative to allow comparison of patient characteristics and survival. So they ended up with 206 samples from 205 patients with a suspicion of mesothelioma, but no definitive diagnosis, and which had a successful P16 performed. And this is the largest sample size studied to date for P16. 23% of samples were cytology samples, 46 were pleural fluid, acidic fluid was 2, 77% of samples were biopsies, pleural biopsy or peritoneal biopsy in 3, one was a lymph node biopsy and one was an orchidectomy. This is a table of the patient characteristics and outcomes. Pretty standard types of patients. The final diagnosis. I'm not sure how they got patients with lung cancer when they're supposed to be very careful picking mesothelial cells. So 80% were mesothelioma, 2% lung cancer, and 19% were benign pleuritis. And then looking at the mesothelioma subtype, they were 43% epithelioid, 6% biphasic, 15% sarcomatoid, and quite a big percentage not otherwise specified. And I'm not sure why they didn't subtype it a bit better than that, but perhaps the biopsies are extremely small. So P16 was positive in 48% of patients, and it was positive in all patients that were positive were mesothelioma patients. So there were 164 mesothelioma patients, so it was 60% sensitive, which I think is roughly what has been shown in other studies. There were no false positive P16 FISH results. So as we know, specificity is 100% and positive predictive value is 100%. This isn't always the case in different studies, but I think it might be related to the quality of the P16 test done, that it needs a lot of good controls and needs to be done properly and interpreted properly. P16 FISH was negative in all 39 benign pruritus, thank goodness, in lung cancer, and in 65 mesotheliomas, so it's got a negative predictive value of 39%. They mentioned that, so they looked at the cutoff area under the curve for the P16 FISH test. And they found that in case of benign pruritus, they could have up to 13% of cells with homozygous deletion of CDKN2A in two cases. So they made sure their cutoff for a positive P16 FISH test was more than 20% and had no false positives. So there's quite a bit about how important this test is to be done properly. Interesting, there was no difference in the sensitivity of the test in different morphological types of mesothelioma. And the sensitivity, which is quite a nice point to make, of P16 FISH was higher in cytology than histology, 75% versus 58%, and it was significant, which is encouraging for cytology diagnosis. And one other thing they found was that the P16 FISH positive mesothelioma was lower, the prevalence was lower in women compared to men. And that was also significantly different. They finally found that P16 FISH positive mesothelioma was associated with significantly worse survival, even after adjusting for confounding variables. That was highly significant. So P16 FISH positive mesothelioma had a worse prognosis, and it was more commoner in men. So the take-home message corroborates previous studies which indicate 100% specificity. Interesting, no increased sensitivity in sarcomatoid mesothelioma. For pleural sarcomatoid mesothelioma, sensitivity of P16 FISH has been reported in 80 to 100%. And the authors say this might be because only 35 in total of 163 cases of mesothelioma in this paper were sarcomatoid, and there may not be enough power to show a difference. And as I mentioned, a lot of the cases weren't even classified. It's suitable for cytology samples, and sensitivity is high, maybe higher than tissue. So it could be put into mesothelioma guidelines. And the worst survival in P16 positive cases needs further study. And as we know, in other studies have shown it's higher in sarcomatoid mesothelioma, which they didn't show. So maybe there's something going on here that they didn't pick up in their study.
Except that they didn't do it on all their mesos. They just did this on the atypical one. So that might be the difference.
No, they did it on their mesos.
I thought up there you said it was only done on, it was P16 was only utilized when atypical mesothelial cells are present, but a definitive diagnosis was not possible.
I think I cut off something there. I think they don't do it on patients that they are happy or are mesothelioma. They only do it on patients with a suspicion.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Maybe those are likely to be, maybe that's the reason, because other studies have looked at definite mesotheliomas.
I think they looked at definite mesotheliomas. They say they normally only do it in cases of atypia that without definite diagnosis. Oh, you're right. Sorry. It's a respective. Now I'm getting myself confused. Sorry. Yeah. It was a retrospective. It reviewed the results of retrospective P16. Yeah, that's right. Very good point, Henry. Yes.
Well, I mean, I think the value of the study is that they're looking at their borderline cases, and so that's a useful differentiator from the other studies. But that's a reason why the numbers turn out a little different.
Yeah, they're looking at something that's slightly different.
You know, I got confused about that too, because so they had quite a few which were negative for P16. Now they did not correlate it with BAP1 expression. So how did they make then the diagnosis of malignant mesothelioma in the cases that were P16 negative if they only included atypical mesothelial proliferations, not the ones where they thought it's mesothelioma already? Did they explain that how they could make the diagnosis in the other cases?
That's another good point.
I think these are just all the patients that have come into their clinic, and a whole number of them are going to have biopsies that show characteristic mesothelioma. That's how I read this. These are the patients coming in the door with a suspected mesothelioma, and they may have a straightforward histologic diagnosis, and they were just doing this test on all comers.
Sometimes I can't see the wood for the trees. I've gone into such detail, but a simple question like that. I read this a while ago and I can't remember now. I did all this a while ago.
That's all right.
That's something else I need to work out. I'll get back to you on that, Henry.
So I think it's probably just an inconsistency in their language. They do say that this was done only in those in whom the diagnosis was suspected. And yet, if you look at their study design, they retrieved all patients who had had the testing. And as we know, testing is often done in cases that, you know, to one of us might seem straightforward, it might be hard for someone else. So the truth is, they looked at everybody who had P16 testing at their medical center, and I doubt all of those were histologically challenging. I mean, to the extent you'd be unable to make a diagnosis. So I think it's just kind of cognitive dissonance between what they said they did and what they actually did. Mm-hmm.
Final diagnosis of mesothelioma was only recorded at least two of the following three criteria fulfilled. Definitive pathological diagnosis of mesothelioma made via pleural biopsy or post-mortem, serial imaging, and the mesothelioma multidisciplinary team. So I think that's how they diagnosed it, Anya, without doing BAP1.
Okay.
I think they basically said, oh, come on, this looks like it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, is a duck, I guess.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I will confirm that. So, yeah. Okay. Last paper for discussion. This was by Chevrier, and I think this was Andrew Chirk. Again, I should have looked at this morning just to confirm myself. Oh, no. Yeah, it was Andrew Chirk and Sanya Dachik were on this. And so the background is that the clinical parameters for evaluating pleural fluid say it's a good test for initial screening for mesothelioma, but not sufficiently sensitive to make the diagnosis in mesothelioma. But as we know, often all we have is pleural fluid on some patients. Biopsies are done. We've had patients with several pleural biopsies and they never seem to get anything that we can diagnose. So the aim of this study was to determine whether testing for BAP1 and I'm going to say P16 status in effusion specimens preceding the definitive tissue diagnosis, malignant pleural and peritoneal mesothelioma would significantly change the diagnostic interpretation and lead to an earlier diagnosis of malignancy. So again, this was a retrospective study, but they did, they basically took patients that were known mesotheliomas from Pittsburgh Medical Center over 5 years, and those ones that had pleural and peritoneal effusion specimens available. So at the time of initial workup, none of the effusion specimens were tested for BAT1 loss or P16 fish at the time of initial diagnostic workup. So that's what they did. They then went and did P16 fish and BAT1 loss to see if they could identify these cases as mesotheliomas. Again, they used 20% of tumor cells for P16 fish, so they had good technique. Samples were considered a true positive if they were labeled as malignant, showed BAT1 loss and or P16 fish. We're running out of time, so I won't spend too long. I think we stop at 8. A total of 99 matched samples were identified in 74 patients. And this is a big issue. I found this hard to read because they kept talking about samples and cases. And I found it really annoying. And I think they had different samples at different times in these patients and they kept them all in. So there's a lot of confusion when they talk about cases or specimens. So specimens and cases were the patients. Anyway, at 67 epithelioid, 7 biphasic cases, no sarcomatoid, obviously these don't shed into the effusion very well. 55 pleural and 19 peritoneal mesotheliomas. So the cytology had been interpreted morphologically as negative malignancy in 18, atypical in 36, suspicious for malignancy in 15, and malignant in 30. They found that BAT1 was lost in 69 cases of mesothelioma. Higher, a little bit higher in pleural than peritoneal, but not significant. And P16 fish was positive in 41 cases of mesothelioma. So not as common. Again, higher in pleural types of mesothelioma. BAT1 loss plus P16 fish positive was found in 31% of cases, 20 pleural and 3 peritoneal. So overall loss of BAT1 and P16 deletion and or would change the diagnostic interpretation in 62%, which wasn't quite significant, effusion specimens. But when you looked at pleural effusion specimens, it was significantly different. BAT1 loss in about half of cases was interpreted as negative or indeterminate, atypical or suspicious. And in 2/3 of those cases, it had been interpreted as malignant. P16 was positive in about 25% of the so-called negative and 45% atypical cases. So BAT1 and or P16 fish testing would have changed the diagnosis from benign to malignant in 7 cases and from atypical to malignant in 10 cases. Therefore, overall change in diagnosis based only on the cytology specimen was estimated at 23%. And I make it estimated because I found it, as I said, very difficult. They talked about specimens and cases. So I'm more interested in patients. So cases in 23%, which is pretty high. The sensitivity of morphological interpretation alone was 30%. Adding testing for BAT1 and P16 resulted in increased sensitivity of 68%, highly significant. Interesting, the group that had that was diagnosed as malignant on morphology alone had the highest proportion of cases with BAT1 and CD and P16 fish. And in one patient, the diagnosis could have been made up to 9 months prior to a definitive diagnosis on the biopsy specimen. So the take-home message was looked at 99 paired specimens, confusing in 74 patients, but good evidence for routine use of validated assays for earlier, more definitive and cytological diagnosis of mesothelioma in effusion specimens. They suggest that stepwise testing, BAT1 first, and if intact, recommend P16 fish. If it's obviously positive or not intact, you don't need to do fish. So identification of BAT1 loss or the fish homozygous deletion in effusion specimens without a mass lesion should prompt a more aggressive pleural or peritoneal tissue sampling.
That without a mass lesion is a real teller there.
It is, it is. And they also mention, you know, they talk about mesothelioma in situ. They're suggesting that might be present, right? And there was a case report in this that I put in the Dropbox where there was a case present for many years and finally became malignant, finally declared itself.
This is a highly selected group, right? I mean, all of these patients, as I understand it, had eventual diagnoses of malignant mesothelioma. Do I have that right?
Yes, they were all diagnosed on biopsy.
So yeah. The thing I'm struggling with is a subset of these patients had negative cytologies. They weren't atypical kind of, they were just
negative. They were called negative.
So mm-hmm. So are they suggesting that we do BAP1 and P16 FISH in that stepwise fashion on all negative effusion cytologies, or only on those that we eventually discover had mesothelioma? Like, I don't know how to apply this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously useful for the atypicals, but they had a substantial number of patients in whom they were just flat negative.
I think if you select your patients outpatient with recurring pleural effusions of no cause, we all know patients like that. They're gone for years sometimes. I think they justify having this done. I don't think every single pleural effusion that comes through needs this done.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what that would look like, right? If we kind of prospectively tested the value of this in all patients with a persistent unexplained pleural effusion, that's a huge N.
Mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. It ain't a very big subset that ends up having mesothelioma. So I just wonder what the payoff would be, but that, opportunity for a good study.
Mm-hmm. I guess if there's a mass, then it would make more sense. But just
if there's a mass, then you don't need those tests.
Pardon?
If there's a mass, then you don't really need the tests.
But if there's a mass and they biopsy and they don't pick up anything sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they will be doing a directed biopsy on those, yeah.
Kelly, do you know why they use the FISH and not MTAP? Is there anything with MTAP? I mean, I could imagine MTAP as being IHC, much faster, less expensive. Is there anything why they might not have used that?
I think it's because that's what they do in this medical center. They do FISH routinely and they don't use MTAP.
So nothing argues against using MTAP, right?
I think so. But I think MTAP can be false positive, false negative, can't it? I think FISH is a little bit more reliable, but generally MTAP's pretty good.
Yeah, I haven't seen that evidence, but maybe I missed that.
I think Andrew Cherik's review on that mentioned that.
Okay, we'll look into that. Thank you.
I'll look into that too.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you.